Okay, so we are studying 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles in parallel, as those books, for the most part, cover the same material. Obviously, we find some information in 1 Kings that is not included in 2 Chronicles and vice versa. And as we have pointed out many times, that in no way is a contradiction that's in the text. We have additive. It's a situation where we add them together to get all of the truth that's revealed. And even on some of those things, we have other information in other books in the Old Testament, sometimes even in the New. So if we're going to understand all that God teaches about anything or informs us of on any subject, then we have to go to look at all that's revealed in God's Word. So these two books, though, do overlap quite a bit, and so we've been following them along in that way. So last time we finished at the end of 1 Kings chapter 9. So this morning we want to look at 2 Chronicles 8. In 2 Chronicles chapter 8, corresponds to 1 Kings 9, 10 through 28. So those last 19 verses of 1 Kings 9, that same material, the same subject is covered here in 2 Chronicles chapter 8. They parallel very, very tightly, actually. So there's not going to be much that we see here that's that is going to be adding information that we didn't see in 1 Kings 9. But let's go ahead and start with the first 10 verses here in 2 Chronicles chapter 8. And let's see, Brother Stephen, would you read that for us? 2 Chronicles 8, 1 to 10.
And it came to pass at the end of 20 years, wherein Solomon had built the house of the Lord and his own house, that the cities which Hiram had restored to Solomon, Solomon took and caused the children of Israel to dwell there. And Solomon went to Hamath-Zobah and rebelled against it. And he built Tadmor in the wilderness and all the stores. And all the store of cities which he built in Hamath. Also he built Beth Horon the upper and Beth Horon the nether fenced cities with walls, gates, and bars. And Bala and all the store cities that Solomon had, and all the chariot cities and the cities of the horsemen, and all that Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem. And Lebanon and throughout all the land of his dominion. As for all the people that were left of the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which were not of Israel, but other children who were left after them in the land whom the children of Israel consumed not, them did Solomon make to pay tribute until this day. But of the children of Israel did Solomon make no servant for his work, but there were men of war and chiefs of his captain of his chariots and horsemen. And these were the chiefs of King Solomon's officers, even 250 that bear rule over the people.
All right. So we're going to review some things for a minute. It just so happens with what's going on, or what's supposed to be going on tomorrow here, it kind of fits in with something we might bring up now. But let's say thousands of years from now, if somebody were able to find records from our location from tomorrow, what would be probably the major thing that they would see in our records from tomorrow? If it, the Lord wills, we have tomorrow. The eclipse, right? I mean, that's the big deal right now. Well, that's always been a big deal for people. Now, We happen to live in a time where something like that doesn't take us by surprise, because with our understanding of science, and we know how the heavenly bodies move and all the physics that that we know, and astronomers and all that do their calculations, we know when eclipses are going to take place. So that is the case from looking to the future. If the Lord wills and we have beyond tomorrow, would it be predictable when the next solar eclipse would be in various locations on Earth? And the answer is yes. We would be able to predict that quite accurately. Well, back in the Bible times, when eclipses occurred, those were big deals too. And now we don't have a complete historical record from peoples that populated various areas in ancient times. We have records of their civilizations with some of their buildings and or ruins, and there's archaeological sites going back to a lot of those places to confirm the locations of things that go back to Bible times. I mean, probably the most noteworthy of those, you go to Egypt and there's the pyramids. I mean, those go back to the time of deep into the Old Testament times when we read about Egypt in the Bible. But as far as having a written record of their histories, there's not a lot of that we have preserved from ancient times, but among the most well-preserved that we do have is from the Babylonian Empire, which really reached its zenith under Nebuchadnezzar, who was their king. And they were meticulous in recording when eclipses occurred, solar and lunar eclipses, and that was one of the things that is found. Those are found extensively in their records, and that's very helpful to us. Why am I bringing all this up? Well, it's very helpful to us because as we can from today go forward in time and know when, if the Lord wills, that everything is still here, when the next eclipses will be. But we can also go backwards in time in the same manner and know when those things would have been in the past. And so when the Babylonians, for example, mention eclipses that occurred at certain times corresponding to the reigns of Nebuchadnezzar, which is what is preserved in their records that we have. Well, that's very helpful because then we can help tie into the years B.C. And there was one that was in Nebuchadnezzar's first year that is dated from when he was considered the emperor after defeating the Egyptians at Carchemish. That was in 605 B.C., and that's a very well-established historical date, mainly based on the tie-in of the eclipse records from Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So that's very helpful because then we have something that we can find in the Bible. We read all about Nebuchadnezzar and his rise and his reign as Emperor of Babylon. And that ties into the history of Israel as it's recorded in the Old Testament. And as we're studying through the kings, we have the duration of the reigns of the kings of Israel. And then later, after the kingdom splits, those of the northern kingdom of Israel and those of the southern kingdom of Judah. And we have the records of how long they reigned. So then that enables us to be able to go back to those dates that are given in the Bible for the reigns of the kings, and then we can tie that into what that would correspond to as far as years B.C. Pretty well, I mean, very closely. So Solomon's reign, and we're studying about him right now. How long did Solomon reign over Israel? 40 years. And who was before him? Well, the two kings of Israel before him were Saul and David. And incidentally, how long did King Saul reign? 40 years. Now that's kind of interesting. As we mentioned a while ago, sometimes we have information in, well, Saul's reign, for example, where's that covered in the Bible? Well, we read about that in mostly in the book of 1 Samuel and in 1 Chronicles. Do either 1 Samuel or 1 Chronicles tell us exactly how many years that King Saul reigned over Israel? No. Well, where do we find it? We find it in the New Testament in the book of Acts. So when Paul the Apostle was preaching in Antioch in Pisidia in Acts chapter 13, we find mention of King Saul and the duration of his reign. He reigned over Israel for 40 years. Well, the Old Testament also several times tells us that David reigned over Israel 40 years, and then we have several verses that also tell us that Solomon reigned for 40 years. So it's interesting, there were three kings over the entire 12 tribes of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon, and all three of them reigned for 40 years. So that's kind of helped, makes it a little easier to remember. But if you want to pinpoint those 40 years that Solomon reigned as king, I mean, that comes out to between 970 and 930 B.C. So if you want to have some idea to how long ago that was from now, I mean, just about 3,000 years ago is when Solomon reigned as king over Israel. But why bring that up? Well, this starts in verse 1 of 2 Chronicles chapter 8. What we also saw there in 1 Kings 9, we've read about up to this point in Solomon's reign as king, we've read about really what kind of events recorded. The material about Solomon's reign up to this point has been primarily about what? Well, what he summarizes there in verse 1. He had built the house of the Lord in his own house. I mean, how much of the material that we've been studying in these books here in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles have been about Solomon's work in constructing the temple, the dedication of the temple, and all of that. That's been the dominant theme or subject in the book so far. Well, we know that he built the house of the Lord first, then he built his own house, and then he's reviewing or summarizing a lot of the other works that were going on in Israel during this period of Solomon's reign, and how many years of this reign of Solomon is this covering, according to verse 1 here in 2 Chronicles 8? 20 years. So this is really a summary of the first half of his reign over Israel. So you can kind of get lost as far as the time aspect of it, except that the Lord then brings us back to that and gives us statements like that to help us to keep that in mind. But so we're looking here, when we get to this point of 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles, we're at the midway point of Solomon's reign as king over Israel. Now, when we studied David's reign, the first half of his reign over Israel was dominated by what? What did we read about mostly that was going on? Now, we do know that he was already, during that period of time, had received God's authorization to ultimately build the temple. But what were the main works that David was having to do in the first half of his reign? That is very much a contrast to what we're reading right here of Solomon. And what was the reason that God gave that he did not permit David to be the one to build the temple? He what now? Yeah. So how much of the first half of David's reign was involved in wars? Where the Lord was subduing the enemies of Israel under him. I mean, that was mostly what he was doing. He started with, well, right there within his own country with Jebus, which became Jerusalem, the city of David. He made his capital, and that's when he moved the Ark of the Covenant there, and then had the idea to build the temple and receive God's approval and authorization to do that. But he was not going to be able to build it himself, but he saved up all of He gathered the materials and organized the work for it to be done and completed by his son Solomon, which is what we've seen now in the first half of Solomon's reign, actually doing that work. But David's reign, especially that first half, was dominated by his the wars, the battles he was fighting to subdue the Philistines and the Ammonites and those other nations around him that God put put down under him. And so that's very different than Solomon. We don't read that. What do we read predominantly about Solomon's reign, especially this first half? It's all about what? Construction, building stuff. So David was having to fight and subdue the enemies, which he did. And God was the one that did that through him. Well, who's enjoying the fruits of all that work David did, where he's done? Solomon's not a king that's going out fighting wars. As we read when we were in those chapters 3 and 4 of 1 Kings, during Solomon's reign, that 40 years, everybody in Israel, every man was dwelling under his vine and under his fig tree, as he summarized it. There was peace in the land. So Solomon is doing a lot of building and a lot of marrying, as we're going to see as it goes on into 1 Kings chapter 11. The first half of his reign is dominated by all this building that he's doing. First, with his priorities being right, was the house of the Lord, the temple. Then he had his own house that he built. And then what else did he build during that time? As we've just read there, those first 10 verses here in 2 Chronicles 8. Starting in verse 2, he mentions the house of the Lord and Solomon's own palace in verse 1. And then in verse 2, he starts talking about his building of what? These different cities. And for what two primary purposes? We can see the... we can see the terms used there in those verses. Verse 4, what kind of cities does he talk about? Store cities. What kind of cities does he talk about there in verse 5? Fence cities. So you had store cities, you had fence cities. What are store cities? Yeah, so he had all of... This is where he would put his stuff, which he had quite a lot of. He had different cities designated for this is where this would be, this is where that would be. And then there were certain cities that were strategic in the land of Israel as far as for their defense, where there would be soldiers posted. So this was during a time of peace. Solomon had those cities that were set to defend Israel, were they to be attacked by their enemies. So he was doing a lot of construction and building of these cities for storing the wealth that was coming into Israel under his time, and also those spent cities. And it also mentions... what we saw particularly city of, when it, and this was material was covered in 1 Kings 9 that we looked at. He talked about the city of Gezer, and we'll see that a little bit when we get down to verse 11. Remember from 1 Kings 9 that the city of Gezer, which was in Israel, who conquered that city and from whom, and then what was it used for? That was a city conquered by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, a city in Israel that was occupied by some of those Amorite people, some of those original Canaanites that the Israelites were supposed to have destroyed utterly. But as we know, there were pockets of those native peoples that had been allowed to live, and in many cases... they caused some great problems for the Israelites. And, I mean, that's why David had to go and fight and conquer Jebus right there in the heart of Israel, that was still occupied by the Jebusites to David's time. So that was, there were situations like that still during that time. Well, Pharaoh took Gezer, and because it was not occupied by Israelites then. But then what was the city used for? Well, Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter, and then that city was given to her because that's where her palace was built. And then she was moved there. And that's going to come up in verse 11. But at any rate, we can see these cities being built for various purposes, including that one for Pharaoh's daughter, Solomon's wife. As it pertains to those native peoples that were still in those pockets in various places in Israel, what did Solomon do with them? Which is what he covers in verses 7 through 10. He put them under tribute, and they were to be the servants. It says in verse 9, of the children of Israel did Solomon make no servants for his work, but they were men of war and chief of his captains and captains of his chariots and horsemen. But the ones that were left in the land that were not Israelites, they were put under tribute. So these were the ones that were taxed heavily to pay for all the work that Solomon was doing. And then they were used in that actual work as the servants rather than the children of Israel themselves. So that's what Solomon did. So if you were an Israelite during Solomon's reign, especially during this period of time we're reading about there, what would your life have been like? I mean, as the saying might be today, they had it good, didn't they? I mean, they had a very good situation. So they weren't the ones being put under tribute to pay for all these things Solomon was doing. They weren't the ones being given all those menial and very difficult tasks to do. Wealth was pouring in. There weren't wars going on. Now, he made soldiers out of these people, so they got to do that, but they weren't out there fighting wars. So, I mean, it was a time of peace and prosperity in Israel. This corresponded to the promises that God had made through the covenant that he had given to Israel through Moses. And so there were blessings promised to them if they kept the Lord's commandment, that this is what their life would be like. God was fulfilling that because they were going back to the time of David. They had been seeking the Lord. They had been keeping his commandments, and that has continued under Solomon. So when do we ever read about such a lengthy time of this kind of spiritual and material prosperity for the children of Israel in the Old Testament? I mean, this is a very high mark, really. Under Joshua, we know that they were given the full blessings that God had promised. But for a sustained period of time, I don't know that we could find anything to match those 80 years under David and Solomon for Israel. And it was the central point was that they were following the Lord during all of that time. Now we're going to see that trouble is on the horizon for Solomon because of all those wives that he had married that were not Israelites. Those women were from other nations. They were princesses that he married, like Pharaoh's daughter. Well, did Pharaoh worship Jehovah? No. What about the daughters of those other kings of all these other nations and principalities around in that area? Were they worshipers of Jehovah? Now we can see during this time Hiram, the king of Tyre, was serving Jehovah, but that was an exception, a very notable exception. But otherwise, these other nations, they worshipped idols. So when Solomon married all those women, he was marrying into married people that had those idolatrous customs. And what did they bring with them when they came to Israel as Solomon's wives. Well, they brought those customs. And rather than Solomon influencing all those wives that he married to turn away from that into Jehovah, it went the other way, didn't it? Solomon, with all of his wisdom, had his heart turned to the worship of those idols, and so he was going to have much trouble from that. And then, of course, he was recovered himself as he repented before it was too late, but there was going to be trouble for him and for the nation that was actually going to persist on into their future, to the duration of it, in fact, because the kingdom was going to be divided as a result and as God's punishment for what Solomon did. So there is trouble on the horizon, but right now we're at the best time in Israel's history that we're reading about here. So Solomon's doing all of this building, all of this wealth is there. I mean, as we read about the temple that he had built, I mean, it's all covered in gold. I mean, this is, what was silver, what was it like in the Solomon's days? You remember what we read earlier in 1 Kings? It was accounted as what? It was of very little value. Because
it was,
what's that? Yeah, like pennies for us, exactly. Because of how abundant it was. I mean, can you imagine where silver, I mean, pure silver, would be so abundant that it would be considered of little to no value. We wouldn't even regard it. Well, that's the way it was then. So, I mean, there was gold and silver and abundance, wealth, untold there in Israel during this time. So, this is what's going on in Israel during these years. So this is Solomon's building all these things, and this would be the finest materials, great wealth, as we know, and we'll see mentioned again these ships that Solomon made, and because that was in 1 Kings 9, it's going to be here in these last verses in 2 Chronicles 8, but he was building ships for the Red Sea, and Hiram provided the experts to help sail them, and he had his ships plying the Mediterranean. So there were ships going all around to those kingdoms in Africa and Arabia, and what would have been the what we would know of as Southern Europe today, the Mediterranean. So all around that Mediterranean area. In the Middle East, Solomon's ships were going everywhere. And what are they bringing back? Everything. And so he's becoming very, very wealthy, unlike any before or after him. Alright, so we're getting a glimpse of that with all that he's building in all these places throughout Israel for these purposes. So and then it summarizes verse 10 there, the chief of King Solomon's officers, those 250 that bear rule over the people. So he's organized his kingdom. The ones that are Israelites are the ones at the top. And so Solomon's subjects, they have it well during these days. All right, let's go ahead and read 11 to 18 here. 2 Chronicles chapter 8, Brother Dave, you got that?
And Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh out of the city of David into the house that he had built for her. For he said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, the king of Israel, because the places are holy, compared to the ark of the Lord had come. Then Solomon offered her offerings unto the Lord on the altar of the Lord, which he had built before the porch. Even after a certain rate every day, offering according to the commandment of Moses on the Sabbaths and on the new moons and on the solemn feasts, three times in the year, even in the feast of unleavened bread, and in the feast of weeks, and in the feast of tabernacles. And he appointed according to the order of David's fathers, choices of the priests to their service, Levites to their charges, to praise and minister before the priests, as the duty of every day required. For priests and Levites concerning any matter, or concerning the treasures. And all the work of Solomon was prepared until the day of the foundation of the house of the Lord, and until it was finished, so the house of the Lord was perfected. Then went Solomon to Ezion-Geber, to the Eloth, and the seaside of the land of Edom. And Huram sent him by the hands of his servants, ships and servants that had knowledge of the city. And they went with the servants of Solomon to the Ophir, and took them 450 talents of gold, and brought them to King Solomon.
Okay, now, from verses 11 through 16, he's really showing us, this is giving us the spiritual perspective of Solomon's thinking and what he was doing during the first half of his reign. Is he thinking right? Does he have wise and righteous judgment in the decisions that he's making, what he's doing as King of Israel during these years? Absolutely. Even the part where it explains, you know, this is a little bit of a tidbit that we don't have there in the account of 1 Kings 9. 1 Kings 9 has some information about where Pharaoh's daughter went that we don't find in 2 Chronicles 8, but we find something there in verse 11 that we don't find stated like that in 1 Kings 9. So here's where we can compare the two, and we have the information added together to give us the whole picture. Well, 1 Kings 9 tells us it's Gezer, is the place where Pharaoh's daughter's palace was built in that city that was taken by Pharaoh himself for her from these Amorite people that occupied it in the land of Israel. So then that's where Pharaoh's daughter was placed. Now, 1 Kings 9 didn't have those words that we have of Solomon's recorded here, verse 11, in 2 Chronicles 8. Why did Solomon not just build a place for her in Jerusalem? Why make a place for her in another city in Israel? And it wasn't just so that he wouldn't have to deal with her. I mean, it was he was not just marrying all these women and then getting them out of Jerusalem so that they wouldn't be an irritation to him. So, what was his thinking there? What was his reason for putting her out of Jerusalem in Gezer?
Jerusalem was a holy city, and Egyptians worshipped strange gods.
That's right. So, at this point, this is for a spiritual purpose. He's noting the distinction between what is right in following the God of heaven and someone who's not, even though it was his own wife. So he was making that decision to have her there on the basis of the fact that she was not a follower of God and did not belong in a holy city that was set apart for God, as this is now not just the political capital of Israel established by David, but where Solomon has now built the temple. So this is the religious center of the nation. So would it be appropriate to have this foreign woman from an idol-worshipping nation also happen to be the nation that was the subjugator of the people of God for all those centuries until the Exodus, in a land that God had forbidden his children to go back to? But would it be appropriate for an Egyptian woman to be there in Israel, especially as Solomon's wife? I mean, she would, here you would have there in his palace in that city, occupying Pharaoh's daughter, occupying such a high position in the land, in the kingdom, right there where the people are supposed to come to worship Jehovah. Solomon saw that was not appropriate, and that was what was in his mind and the judgment that he had to have her palace built in a different place. So is his judgment at this point, is he still clearly distinguishing between what is right in following God as opposed to any other way of living? Yeah. Now, what's sad is that is going to get blurry in his mind. He's going to lose that distinction. He's going to get carried away. So that's sad to see what's going to happen. But at this point, he's still seeing it right. And he's still making the right decisions. And then everything to do with the building of the temple as it's going down through summarizing that. He had burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar that was before the porch at a certain rate every day. And this was according to what in verse 13? According to the commandment of Moses. So I mean, what's involved in every one of these things that he's doing? What is the will of God? What is the will of the God of heaven, the creator of all things? What's the right thing to do according to what God says? I mean, that is what is behind everything that he's doing at this point. So from that perspective, he is exactly right now following the footsteps of his father David, isn't he? I mean, what was always in David's mind in every decision that he made? And he trained Solomon in that. And Solomon is following that training right now. And so everything is by what is according to God's commandments. And he mentions all those feast times, the solemn feasts, the new moons and Sabbaths, the solemn feasts that were three times in the year. And he names those three feasts in verse 13, which, what was the first one of the year? The Feast of Unleavened Bread that went with the Passover. And then the Feast of Weeks, because it was 7 weeks later, 7 weeks and a day, which is why it's also called Pentecost. And then the Feast of Tabernacles, which was the last one in the year. But he had those three feasts, those three solemn feasts in Israel, which all the males were commanded by God to come to Jerusalem, or to come to the place that God had chosen. It wasn't Shiloh when the tabernacle was in existence. Now God has changed that to Jerusalem, where the temple now is. But what he's those things that he was doing there that is that it mentions in verses 12 and 13, was that able to be done during that 100-year approximate 100-year period of time, going back to even before King Saul's reign and throughout David's reign until Solomon finished the temple? Well, what had happened? What had happened before Saul was king, when there were still judges? Samuel was the judge, and when Samuel, when he was in his younger years, who was the high priest of Israel? Eli, and Eli had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, that were what kind of men? Men of Belial, wicked men. They corrupted the sacrifices. They were doing wickedly. They are even at the door of the tabernacle with their immorality. It was they were doing abominable, wicked things that directly involved the very things that the Israelites were supposed to be doing to keep them close to God. They were making them despise that. So Israel during that time was not following the Lord like they should. And the sons of the high priest were very involved in the spiritual decline in Israel. And God punished them by, well, he killed them. And on the day they died at the hands of the Philistines in a defeat of the army of Israel by the Philistines also took the Ark of the Covenant that Hophni and Phinehas had brought into the camp of Israel, thinking that that object was going to give them a victory when they weren't following the Lord. And so God had that ark. He delivered it in the hands of the Philistines. They carried it back to their own land. Of course, he plagued them for that until the Philistines shipped it back to Israel. But it was in the tabernacle at Shiloh was destroyed. So there's no tabernacle now. The Ark of the Covenant was gone for a while. Then it was returned, but it didn't go. There's no tabernacle for it to go to. There's no more structure with the most holy place. So what God had commanded about the solemn feast days, the sacrifices on the altar that was supposed to be before the tabernacle, Well, all of that was supposed to be at that location where the tabernacle was, where the Ark of the Covenant sat with the mercy seat, the cherubim, in the most holy place. And then you had the holy place where the priests would do their works. Well, how was that done for that, basically, that 100-year period from the destruction of the tabernacle in Shiloh until the temple was completed by Solomon? Which is exactly what he's talking about right here. Those were commandments that were impossible to obey because during that period of time, because there was no place, there was no building. But now that the temple being finished, what does Solomon immediately do? This is why this was priority number one for David. He wanted that problem for the nation of Israel to be solved. Well, it is now. And so once it is solved, and Solomon is making sure that everything is going according to the commandment of God by Moses, then that all those feast days are being observed, all the sacrifices and those holy days, and everything is being done according to the word of God. And then he appointed according to the order of his father David. You remember those last several chapters of 1 Chronicles that gave the details of David's organization for the ones to do all these works in Israel under his son. So David had set the table for all of this. Well, Solomon's following through with it. How large does the shadow of David loom over Israel even during the first half of the reign of his son Solomon, with all that's being done to follow the Lord? How much of that do we see the influence of David still being felt in the land of Israel? I mean, he was the one that got all of this in motion and trained his son to do it. So we see the effects of David and his work still living on there. Wouldn't we all like that to have our works that we're doing on this earth for the Lord to be still accomplishing good long after we're gone and then on into eternity? I mean, that's what we're here for. And it's very encouraging to see how God used David in his life and how he continued to give good fruit to all that good and that David did in his life. It says, "For so had David, the man of God, commanded," as he puts it at the end of verse 14. And they didn't depart from that commandment in verse 15 that he had given to the priests and Levites concerning any matter or concerning the treasures. So all of that Solomon that he did in verse 16, from the foundation of the house of the Lord until it was finished, that he did it according to what was right, so the house of the Lord was perfected. Everything was completed and done right according to God's way. So we're going to see that in contrast to what's coming. But, I mean, if we want to see the way it's supposed to be in Israel, when can you ever go and find a better time to look at the way things were supposed to be, the way things were supposed to be in Israel, with God, between God and His chosen people, Israel? This is it. I mean, this is the best example that we're going to find, especially for such a sustained period of time. Well, then that chapter concludes those last two verses with those ships that Solomon made at Ezion-Geber. And then it was at the seaside in the land of Edom. So that would be at the Red Sea. And then Hiram, which is that king of Tyre, we read about this at the end of 1 Kings 9 also. He provided the servants that knew the sea and how to sail the ships, because that's what they did. And so he helped Solomon, and then those ships start going. They go to Ophir, which is a land known for its gold, and they're bringing back piles of gold. So he builds the ships, and how long does it take before those ships are coming back with wealth untold? I mean, that we can see how God is making Solomon and all Israel to prosper in these days while they're doing everything according to the commandment of God. We have, before we get to the sad part of 1 Kings 11, when Solomon has his heart turned away from the Lord by his wives, before that, we've still got Well, one more chapter of 1 Kings, that's chapter 10, and the corresponding chapter, 2 Chronicles 9, that is, so those are the same material there covered in those two chapters, but we have the Queen of Sheba coming to hear the wisdom of Solomon. So that's another very encouraging thing that we get to read about. That's an example that Jesus himself uses in the New Testament of this woman that greatly valued God and his wisdom, that she would come from so far away to hear those words. And so we're going to have that situation to study in the next chapters of 1 Kings 10, 2 Chronicles 9 that we want to start next time, Lord willing. But we'll get to that then. So we still have that good part left before we have to start reading about Solomon's problems. But anyway, we'll continue that, Lord willing, next Lord's Day. We're very glad for each one of you that were able to be here this morning.